IY.
I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. It was an energetic President Obama who delivered the State of the Union last night, promising to use executive action if Congress can't or won't pass legislation on a range of issues.
But what I offer tonight is a set of concrete, practical proposals to speed up growth, strengthen the middle class, and build new ladders of opportunity into the middle class. Some require congressional action, and I'm eager to work with all of you. But America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
He focused his hour-long speech largely on efforts to help the middle class and the working poor, including increasing the minimum wage.
In the coming weeks, I will issue an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their federally funded employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour, because if you cook our troops' meals or wash their dishes, you should not have to live in poverty.
Some of the president's proposals, like immigration reform and expanding early childhood education, are not new. He also goaded the Republicans to come up with an alternative to the Affordable Care Act.
Now, I do not expect to convince my Republican friends on the merits of this law. But I know that the American people are not interested in refighting old battles. So, again, if you have specific plans to cut costs, cover more people, increase choice, tell America what you do differently. Let's see if the numbers add up. But let's not have another 40-something votes to repeal a law that's already helping millions of Americans like Amanda.
He was referring to Amanda Shelley, one of the invited guests. Obama ended on an emotional note, recognizing the service and sacrifice of Army Ranger Sergeant First Class Corey Remsburg, who was seriously wounded in Afghanistan on his 10th, make that 10th, deployment. Well, we've invited Dick Pullman and Mark Zandi to join us on Radio Times. Dick Pullman writes the National Interest blog at WHYYsNewsWorks.org. He's also a full-time faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania as writer-in-residence. And Dick Pullman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Just took a sip of water.
Thank you, Marty.
And joining us from the studios of Moody's is Mark Zandi. He's chief economist for Moody's Analytics. And Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Dick, let me begin with you. And one of the really strong takeaways from last night is that President Obama is going to use this thing called executive action or executive orders to, in a sense, as a workaround for Congress. What does that mean the president can or can't do?
Well, I think it's in part, I think it partly means he can't do a lot. You need to do any really big transformative stuff, the kind of stuff that he envisioned, I think, when he took office and then he campaigned on in 08, you need Congress. You need bipartisan legislation in Congress. You need bipartisan cooperation. And I think my takeaway from the speech last night was basically he was saying, in essence, I'm not expecting Congress to do it much, and so I'm going to try to work around them to the extent that I can. Now, having said that, executive orders are quite limited, I think, in their effect. And, you know, I think I wrote something this morning about that they mostly fiddle around the margins. Mm. You know, the clip you just played where he said he wants to, where he signed the executive order to help workers who are federal contract workers and raise their minimum wage. I mean, that's new federal contract workers going forward. So that's like, I don't know, a few hundred thousand people, perhaps. To raise their minimum wage for millions, you need bipartisan legislation. So executive orders, they're limited in scope. There's so many things he cannot do with executive orders, and even the ones that he's signing, they can be undone. Maybe this is the most important thing. They can be undone by future presidents with their own stroke of the pen.
So he's really scaled back those ambitions of, what, 5 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, the title on my blog this morning was that he's caving to the GOP's audacity of nope.
Audacity of nope, saying no a lot to President Obama. Mark Zandi, I'd like to talk to you about this minimum wage issue. And as the president said last night, he has raised the minimum wage for very specific federal workers. One of the criticisms coming from a number of Republicans is that it hurts businesses and it even hurts the working poor. Where do you stand on this notion of the minimum wage, whether it's good or bad for the economy?
Well, I would support an increase, a modest increase in the minimum wage from its current just over $7 an hour to something closer to that $10 that the president mentioned. You know, there are winners and there are losers in an increase in the minimum wage. The winners would be the working poor. They would benefit from the higher wages. Some would lose their jobs, but that's very, very modest in the grand scheme of things. So on net, they would be winners. The losers would be the businesses that have to pay the higher wage. It's going to come out of their pocket. It means lower profits. And if they're able to pass on some of their higher costs to consumers in the form of higher prices, then, of course, consumers would be a loser. But I think that's quite modest as well. So it's very important to realize that the minimum wage, an increase in the minimum wage, does create winners and losers. But it does, at the end of the day, help the working poor. And if that's our goal, and I think it's a laudable goal, then it should be increased.
Does it put, though, more money in the economy? And by that, I mean, Mark, by paying people more. And we're only talking about, what, $20,000 a year if it's about $10 an hour. But if you're putting more money into the economy, that helps improve the economy?
Sure. These folks that receive the higher wages, you know, generally they're living paycheck to paycheck. So if they get an increase in their wage, then they're going to spend it, and it's going to end up in the economy, and that helps. But of course, the beneficiaries of that increased spending aren't necessarily the employers that are paying the higher minimum wage. So again, there will be losers as a result of an increase. But on net, I think it's a plus.
Well, and Dick, this is an issue that's been around for a number of years now, and it looks at the sort of politics of it, the parties are very divided on this issue, with Democrats very much in support and Republicans largely opposed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, one of the ways I think to look at the, maybe this is just my predilection since I, you know, look at politics, is that you can look at a lot of what was said last night as code for the 2014 midterm elections. And the minimum wage issue sort of fits right into that, because I think what they need, what the Democrats really need in the midterm, is I don't want to say ginned up, sounds pejorative.
Yeah.
Let's just say a revved up Democratic base to come out and vote in November. And they got, generally speaking, the president's party, and this goes for almost all midterms, a president's party is usually less motivated in the midterms. It's usually the out party that's more motivated, the base. That was certainly the case in 2010 with the Tea Party takeover. So you've got issues that perhaps can rev up the Democratic base. The minimum wage is one of those issues that can perhaps get the liberal base to come out and vote. And so I think, there's a lot of talk about that in Democratic strategists, but also it's not just that. They think it's a popular issue with the public. The polls show that the majority of Americans do support a minimum wage increase. State-by-state polls show that as well. So I think Obama kind of calculates that, this is one of these things where it's perhaps also can bring in perhaps some swing independent voters to vote in November.
Mark, going back to you and listening to the president talk, and even just the words and the tone that he used, it seemed he was careful about his optimism about the state of the economy. And while there are some good signs, there is a sense among the people, broadly speaking, that they don't feel so good about the economy. Do you understand what feels like a kind of a disconnect?
Well, actually, I'll have to say he was more upbeat than I thought he would be. I thought it was a very optimistic speech, and he certainly started off in a very optimistic way, going through some of the economic achievements of the last few years. But I think it is important to recognize that a lot of people have not really participated in the economic recovery so far. The unemployment rate is still very high. It's coming down, but it's still 6.7%, and an unemployment rate that would be more consistent with a full employment economy would be probably closer to 5.5%. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's a lot of people that have stepped out of the workforce because they're discouraged, a lot of underemployed people working part-time because they can't find a full-time job. And perhaps most importantly, in terms of how people feel, is their pay. People's incomes have not been rising after you account for inflation, so real wages have remained stagnant since the economic recovery began. And so that goes to the kind of ennui out there people are feeling with regard to how the economy is performing. So There's good reasons to be, you know, cautious and nervous. But I'll have to say, I thought the president was more upbeat and optimistic than I had expected.
Dick, do you see a discouraged public or a public that perhaps, when you look at the president's public opinion ratings and even the ratings of Congress as well, kind of a sense that perhaps we have a government that really can't fix our problems?
Yeah, I think they're discouraged in part because the president raised expectations so high. I mean, he came in, you know, basically, campaigning as a transformative figure, that he was going to, change the tone in Washington. And, of course, a lot of candidates come in and say they're going to change the tone in Washington. I think I was just quoting George W. Bush,
exactly.
As a matter of fact, saying
yes,
the same thing.
Yes, that's a familiar ring.
But, you know, but Obama basically came on the national stage in 2004 at the convention, the Democratic convention, saying, you know, we're not just the red states of America or the blue states of the United States, which was his way of saying, you know, we can cross party lines and solve our problems jointly. So there hasn't been, and that hasn't happened. And you know, one can make the argument, and I think the argument is empirically solid, that Republican obstruction has been there from day one, and Mitch McConnell gave voice to that in the first term, saying that their top priority was to defeat him, as opposed to solving problems. So that's been there from the start. But what the Republicans have actually been, I guess you can argue, smart about, is that when you block a president and you prevent him from making things better, perhaps as fast as the public wants, he gets dragged down as well. And so we have these polls now where, I forget, there was one the other day that I quoted yesterday, which had him at something like, how much confidence do you have, a great deal or not, in the president? And he was like something, I think the thumbs up was something like 39%. But the thumbs up for the Republicans in Congress was 19%. And you think about that, 81% of the American public says that they don't have confidence in the Republicans. So both sides are hurt by this. And so I think that sort of feeds into this broader disillusionment. But I think, you know, Mark hit on something also, was that, it's been a completely uneven recovery. And the president has acknowledged this time after time. And that kind of leads into a lot of the talk he's had about income inequality,
right,
and how this issue, how that has widened. And it's been going on, like he said last night, for 30 years under both presidents. But, you know, if not now, when? You know, when are we ever going to be attacking that problem?
Well, you know what? I'm going to put that to you, Mark Zandi, after this very short break. We are talking about the president's State of the Union address last night. I played some clips from that address. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call. Tell us what you thought of the speech last night. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Mas Cohen or at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Legendary pianist Radu Lupu joins Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra for Bartok's Third Piano Concerto. Yannick Nézet-Séguin also conducts Dvorak's Sixth Symphony and Smetana's The Moldau. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Radu Lupu in concert with Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Mas Cohen. Thanks for listening to Radio Times. And if you are a member or supporter of WHYY, I thank you for that too. If you've never been a supporter, take that next step and become a member. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Let me suggest that you become a sustainer at the $10 a month level. Your pledge will be automatically renewed until you tell us to stop. It's easier for you, and it's definitely easier for us. Here's that phone number, 1-888-345-9499. Again, pledge online at WHYY.org. You know what you get by listening to WHYY 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of news and information and entertainment. On Radio Times, we keep you up to speed on local, national, and international news and introduce you to interesting people and ideas, and you are part of the conversation. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Dick Pullman. He writes the National Interest blog at WHYY's newsworks.org site, and also Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics. We're talking about the president's State of the Union address last night, and there were, I guess, four, if you count a Spanish language response to the president's speech coming from Republicans, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Mark Zandi, let me put the income inequality question for you. And I mean, if you run the numbers, it looks like there is a growing gap between the rich and the poor in this country, and the middle class often feeling like it's just barely treading water. The president spoke a bit about that last night, but he also said this was something like 30 years in the making. Taxes have been raised a little bit on rich people in this country. Was there anything in the president's speech last night that told you that this issue can be addressed through some of his proposals?
I think most immediately would be the increase in the minimum wage. That goes right to this issue of income inequality, and that would have an immediate effect. He also mentioned another tax benefit called the Earned Income Tax Credit.
Right.
Which is probably a better way to helping the working poor than the minimum wage. And that has historically had bipartisan support. And in my view, that would be a much better way to help the working poor now quickly than raising the minimum wage. But regardless, that he mentioned it and spent some time on it. I think another policy issue that would be very helpful to addressing the income inequality issue, at least over the next 3, 5, 10 years, is foreign immigration. I think immigration reform would be very important because you have a lot of immigrants, illegal immigrants, that are kind of locked into bad jobs. They can't move up. They can't take promotions. They can't move easily to find better jobs because of their situation. And if we have immigration reform, I think that would help them immensely. And I think that would go a long way to helping the income inequality issue. And also, if we allow for more highly skilled and educated foreign workers to come here, stay here, if they're educated here, I think that would generate a lot of growth and jobs for everyone, because by definition, they're risk takers. And I think that would be very important to addressing income inequality. And the other thing that's very important longer run is early childhood education. There's a lot of really good research that shows this is incredibly important to the development of skills and talents, and we underinvest in that. And if we do invest in that more aggressively, I think that long run, you know, this isn't going to matter next year or even 5, 10 years down the road, but a generation from now, it could make a very significant difference to the issue of income inequality. So there's lots of things we can do, but it's going to take time because it took us a long time to get into this fix.
Indeed. Well, and going back to you, Dick Pullman, and even what you wrote in your blog today, describing a bit of the speech about sounding a lot like Groundhog Day, the idea that we have heard some of these proposals before, including immigration reform, including early childhood education.
Yeah. So there was one line in the there was one line last night on early education where he said, I'm quoting here, "Last year I asked this Congress to help states make high-quality pre-K available to every four-year-old. As a parent, as a president, I repeat that request tonight." And so, you know, and immigration reform, like you said, you know, the problem, particularly with immigration reform, is that the House, the Senate actually passed something last year. Went to the House and went into the Bermuda Triangle and was never heard from again. And I don't know, you know, what were the odds of something of the House Republicans actually moving on some path to citizenship legislation this year? I mean, almost zero, in part because, well, it's a midterm election year. And a huge number of the House Republican members are cocooned in safe districts, maybe predominantly white districts, and their paths to reelection, you know, it's smoother if they don't act on Latino aspirations. They don't have to worry about those votes. It may hurt the party perhaps long term. Again, in 2016, when they want to have a more diverse electorate support them in a presidential race. Mm-hmm. But there was a piece just the other day in the New York Times where we're saying that a lot of Republican strategists are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, let's focus on these midterms first. And, you know, that argues against doing something, unfortunately, on immigration reform.
But when you look even at the Senate bill as it stands, the road to citizenship is something like 12 years. I mean, it's not as if it would happen anytime soon. So even a bill that is agreed on by members of the Senate largely, at least by majority, still seems a long way off.
Yeah, it seems a long way. And that's the best scenario that we have. But, you know, see, the opposition just, you know, they use a word like amnesty.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has a kind of visceral impact. And people who look at the fine points, like you just mentioned, are just going to think amnesty sounds like something that's instantaneous just because of the visceral aspect of the word.
You know, Mark, I wonder whether organizations like the Chamber of Commerce and other businesses might prod Congress to move on this issue of immigration, because if it's good for business, it might be good for them as well.
And they will. I'm actually much more optimistic about the prospects of immigration reform. Even this year, I think it's a reasonable possibility. And, you know, we may not get a piece of legislation that provides a path to citizenship, but it could be a path to legal status. And once you establish a path, then lots of good things will happen very quickly. And these folks that are kind of trapped in poor jobs will be able to start looking for better ones and get better ones. So I actually think there's good prospects for that. And I think that down the road, when the economy is back up and running and we are close to full employment, and believe it or not, Marty, that will happen.
I know, and you're always so optimistic, yeah. Mark Zandi, I have to say
and
that.
And I am more optimistic than I've been in quite some time. I think everything's coming together quite well for that prospect to occur. But once unemployment's back, close to 5%, the biggest problem we're going to have isn't unemployment. It's going to be a lack of skilled, educated, talented workers, and businesses are going to start to scream. And once they start screaming loudly, then if we don't get immigration reform this year, we'll get it then.
Well, let me just pick up on that, because the president talked about the millions of jobs that have been created since he became president. But when you drill down, Mark, a lot of those jobs are maybe $10 an hour, sort of low-wage jobs. And even when you look at manufacturing and you see what people are getting paid now, it's like $14 or $15 an hour as opposed to $20 to $25 an hour because of, negotiations with unions. Are we creating good middle-class jobs?
We haven't. Most of the job growth, the 8 million or so jobs the president referred to, have been lower-paying jobs in retail, leisure, and hospitality. And as you rightly point out, even in manufacturing, some mm-hmm. of those jobs are at lower pay than they have been historically. But we are starting to see job growth broaden out and up into middle-income and higher-income higher pay scale kind of occupations. And I expect that trend to continue. We're going to see housing pick up, and that's going to mean a lot of construction jobs, more manufacturing, trucking jobs, financial services jobs, and those are all in the middle part of the pay scales. One of the biggest hits to middle income groups has been all the job losses in government. A lot of the K-12 emergency responders, even police, we've scaled back those jobs, and that's over. State and local governments are doing much better, and I expect to see some job growth there. So you're right. This recovery has been hard on everyone, and the jobs that have been created have been lower paying, but that's changing, and I expect that to change much more obviously in the next few years.
And that's Mark Zandi. He's chief economist for Moody's Analytics. Also with us, Dick Pullman, writes the National Interest blog at WHYY's NewsWorks website. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times to get two perspectives on the president's State of the Union address last night. We do want to talk about the the Republicans' responses. And we do want to take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moscoe. And if you watched the speech, what was your takeaway? Let me get Paul from Levittown to join our conversation. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you, Marty. I guess I'm going to be echoing something that was said previously. I didn't get to see it. I got to listen to it. And I remember that this man was a college constitutional law professor before he got this job that he has now. He'll probably go back to that. He stands up there and he teaches, in my opinion, and he's a great teacher if people will just pay attention to him. One thing I noticed that he stated, climate change is settled. It is a fact, which is the truth. But I wonder how many of the opposing party would have the integrity, the honesty, to say the same thing. And that's my whole comment. Thank you.
Paul, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Dick, picking up on what he said, do you think if he's a good teacher, as Paul says, do you think members of Congress want to be students?
Well, I can answer that. One way to – let me just back up on one thing.
Sure.
If people would only listen, I think Paul said referring to the public here, I saw some polls that before the speech that said that roughly 65% of the public was not planning to watch it. I think it's probably fair to say that most, maybe a perhaps disproportionate number of majority of the people who did watch it are Obama supporters, you know, wanting to sort of, you know, get reinforced, as opposed to sort of people who watch Fox News who would not tune in. So he's arguably maybe over the air preaching to the choir, and a lot of other people probably at this point tuning out. And whether that, you know, fairly or not, in the sixth year of a presidency, in this era where we like consume our public figures so rapidly on 24/7 Twitter sphere and all that, I think a president has a pretty high hurdle to keep the attention of the public and to have the public listen now. And it's doubly so, I think, for that the Republicans in that chamber. I mean, you know, Twitter being the snarky medium it is.
Indeed.
I had a tweet last night after he said that global warming is a fact. I tweeted something about how Republicans are probably in the chamber probably grabbing their phones and punching in dictionary.com to look up the definition of the word. Because it's frustrating when you've got a virtual scientific consensus, and I'm talking whatever it is, 98%. Who says, you know, let's accept this and then do something about it. But if you're not willing to do something about it, then nothing's going to get passed. And I think there have been polls saying that there is a disproportionately large percentage of people, Republicans in the chamber, in the House in particular, who are climate change deniers and perhaps are taking their cues from the base, which, again, you know, dominates voting in safe districts. So that's the frustration I think that Obama faces on that.
Mark, let me segue from that to the president's discussion about energy, about natural gas, about the development of solar, seeing this as a positive sign from his perspective that we're much more energy independent. Is that a good thing for the U.S. economy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any debate about that. And this came out of nowhere, right? I mean, if you think back a few years ago, we were rightly very, very nervous about our dependence on foreign energy, and that's changed quite a bit. In fact, we are seeing such a ramp up in oil and natural gas production that, a few years down the road, the only oil we won't import any natural gas at all, and we'll probably be exporting it. The only oil we'll be importing is probably a couple 3 million barrels a day from Canada. So, this has been very, very dramatic and very positive, and it augurs well for our prospects going forward. It's very important for our manufacturing base, particularly natural gas. It's a key input into a lot of manufacturing activity. And so we're seeing a lot of manufacturing companies set up shop here and expand operations because they know they're going to get cheap natural gas for many years to come. So this is – and the real benefit will come if we, as the president pointed out, can figure out a way to get natural gas into our transportation network. You know, trucks and cars are fueled by oil. If we can get natural gas into the trucking system, let's say – That'll be a huge plus for the economy. So this is nothing but upside for us. It's all very good news. Of course, the one thing that could short-circuit it is if we have some kind of environmental disaster as we try to pull all this out of the ground. So barring that, though, this should be a big, big plus for our long-term growth prospects.
Let me get that. It looks like Peter from Wyomissing to join our conversation. And, Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was disappointed that he didn't take the opportunity, as Karzai just, I think yesterday morning or the day before, blamed us for the series of IED attacks and other explosions in Afghanistan, to say, look, we gave them more than enough time to sign the security agreement. They haven't signed. We set a deadline back in December, or actually November. That's it. You know, as commander-in-chief, I'm not going to take my troops being insulted, their sacrifices minimized, and even when the Taliban admits they're responsible, and keep extending the deadline. This is ridiculous. We're not playing games. We're out of there. He didn't do that. And I felt both frustrated and, in a way, betrayed that he sets a deadline. And the people as a whole, or at least in our area, for whatever reason, left, right, middle, all want us out. And I don't think he gets that.
Well, you know, Peter, let me ask you a question. Do you think that would be an appropriate thing for the president to say in a public address? Or do you think your criticisms, complaints, concerns are being addressed to Karzai privately?
They may have been addressed to Karzai, but they're obviously falling on deaf ears, because if you look at what's being reported that he said in the last few weeks, he keeps torquing it up a notch. He's not, like, dialing it down. Right. And just today, his minister said, well, the U.S. should give up on its concerns about not having troops tried by Afghani courts. So, you know, and they released IED bombers who we had turned over to them for trial. So the past few weeks, he may be discussing it, but he's not. Karzai's not responding. As far as using a public forum, why not? Unite the country, send a loud and clear message, not just to Karzai, but to others, that once in a while, our deadlines are deadlines.
Okay, fair enough, Peter. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me toss this over to you, Dick, because you did talk about basically ending their war in Iraq and also winding down and essentially ending the war in Afghanistan in a year's time. But we're talking about the messy end of wars. I mean, we're not talking about peace signings and then rebuilding countries and becoming allies. These are very messy wars with very messy ends.
Well, messy wars with unforeseen and unforeseeable future consequences. There's been a lot of violence in Iraq lately. There were stories the other day about, the Obama administration has relied a lot on the drones, and we haven't. You know, that's a whole hour right there, right?
Yes.
And I'm sure you've done it.
Yes.
I mean, it's been effective in some ways, getting rid of people that we want to be rid of without having to have inflicted casualties on us. But apparently, what I read the other day was that if we're reducing our footprint drastically in Afghanistan, it can perhaps imperil some of where we have the drone stations, and it affects the drone program, and so we have then the arguments about pro and con about the use of drones. This is one of the reasons that most movies about Iraq and Afghanistan don't do well at the box office.
No.
That I think a lot of Americans actually tune it out. They don't want to be in the wars, but then they also worry. We worry about our security, and so it's all very gray, and I think that's one of the reasons that, frankly, foreign policy took the back end of the State of the Union last night.
We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Dick Pullman and Mark Zandi, talking about the State of the Union address last night. We'll be talking about the Republicans' responses after this very short break, taking more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's only resident professional acting company, supports WHYY and presents Agatha Christie's popular whodunit, The Mousetrap, now through February 9th. Two proprietors of a snowbound manor house, five shifty guests, one police detective, and a rising body count add up to one of the longest-running thrillers of all time. It's murder, pure and simple, and fiendishly fun. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. WHYY is your trusted source for news and information, whether it's happening here in the Delaware Valley, across the nation, or around the world. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Here's the phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at WHYY.org. This is the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, when we take just a few minutes out of our regularly scheduled program to remind you of the important role that you play as a listener. Member. Your pledge of support pays for programs like Radio Times, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Newsworks Tonight, and much, much more, and of course, all that we offer online. We have goals for every break, for every show, and the sooner we meet those goals, the sooner we can end this drive. We believe a show like Radio Times that can go deep and long is invaluable to understanding our complicated world. We believe you believe that too. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Dick Pullman, who writes the National Interest blog at WHYY's NewsWorks website, and Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics. We are dissecting and discussing last night's State of the Union address, and I do want to talk about the Republican responses, plural, and we do want to take some more calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Dig it, you know, it's almost a cliche to say that the Republicans or whoever's out of the White House, who has to, I guess it has to do the response of the State of the Union, has a difficult job on their hands. And I've watched all of those responses over the years, and I still wonder why they can't do a better job. Why is that so hard to respond to the State of the Union?
Well, I mean, part of the reason is, I think, just the asymmetric forums. You know, you've got the president, whichever party is standing up there in front of the entire nation, is the pageantry and all that. And then you've got somebody in a room somewhere, you know, with bad lighting half the time, and 5 minutes and no audience and no spark and no electricity. And how do you boil down? The president had about 6,700 words last night. So how do you boil that down into a rebuttal? That's also affirmative of the opposition party in a few hundred words. And so, you know, just the format alone. And then you've got, of course, you know, whoever's delivering it. And last year, of course, went badly for Marco Rubio, went badly for Bobby Jindal a few years before that. And then beyond that, you've got the fact that this year you had three different Republican responses, four if you include the Spanish translation, but we'll say three. You had the official response, which was Congresswoman Kathy Morris Rogers last night. You had Senator Mike Lee of Utah doing a Tea Party response, and then you had Senator Rand Paul doing a response probably for the brand of Senator Rand Paul.
With the idea of looking at the White House himself.
Yeah, and I think that's indicative also of the problem that the Republicans are not, you know, they're not all sort of singing from the same hymn sheet anymore. You know, we're not in that kind of era now. You know, there's a lot more sort of independent acting going on out there. And so they'll have the official, the unofficial, and the unofficial, unofficial. And so the party doesn't even speak with one voice, and that all further complicates the challenge.
I want to read an email, and this is to you, Mark Zandi, from Michelle. No one wants to mention the side effects of having so many jobs outsourced and products manufactured overseas. Is there some truth to what she says?
It's changing. That historically has been the case. A lot of manufacturers left the U.S. for cheaper places to produce, you know, China being the most obvious. But that has changed. And there's what's being called insourcing. And that's because U.S. manufacturers have done a very good job of getting their cost structures down in line. They're very productive. And I mentioned the cheap natural gas prices, that's helping as well. And, you know, if you're a U.S. manufacturer and you survived the recession, what we went through, you've got to be doing something right. You have to have a low-cost structure, market niche. And so U.S. manufacturing's prospects here are quite good. Now, now having said that, manufacturing is a very productive activity, so it doesn't create a lot of jobs. This isn't going to be an area where a lot of jobs are going to be created. But it is important for our economy, and I think its prospects are quite good.
And what about this, you know, it used to be the most boring word in the world, infrastructure, but, you know, it's not boring because, of
course. Just for you, Marty.
I know. I almost make fun of myself for the way I even say that word. But, it's what holds the country together. It's roads, it's bridges, it's highways. It's, you know, it's the rail system. And as we know, it's in a shambles.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, actually, I think there's a general consensus on that view. I'm not sure anyone who would disagree with it. There is a lot of debate with regard to what role the federal government should play in infrastructure development. But I do sense some bipartisan consensus coming together around ideas to marry government resources with private resources. There's a lot of investors who want to really get in and invest in infrastructure. And so if we can figure that out, I think we'll get more infrastructure. But you're absolutely right. This is so key to long-term economic growth as well. And we really have not, we've underinvested in this, and it's a real problem. I mean, I know this. I get on that Acela going to New York or D.C., and I think it got below 20 degrees, and they were canceling all the Acelas. It's unimaginable that, that we're in that kind of situation.
Well, go to Europe, and maybe, you know, you have to recover from a war, but go to Europe, and you've got a really great rail system. And years ago, I remember driving in Croatia, and this was after a war, on a brand-new highway system. And, I'd never done anything like that in my life before. Dick, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was just saying, I was actually going to say something you just said, Marty, which is that when I traveled in Europe, and it's just, you know, I marvel on how you get on these in France. When you go from you take the Channel train from London, and then you get into France, and somewhere in the northern countryside of France, they make an announcement over the system that we're now traveling at, I'm translating here, we're now traveling at 190 miles an hour or something like that, just hurtling along, and smooth as can be. And it's like, why can't we do these things? And the roads, we have to go back to the fact that Obama introduced a bill, I don't know if this was a year and a half, 2.5 years ago, I lose track, a road repair infrastructure bill that was, it was a twofer, it was going to create jobs. And, it stalled, and it hasn't gone anywhere since. Mm-hmm. And, and he made only passing oblique references to that again last night. And, it's like giving up on that, sounds to me.
But, Mark, do you think the sort of inaction from Congress hurts the economy? I mean, it certainly hurts the president and what he's trying to do. But do you think it has had a negative effect on our overall economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think the brinkmanship clearly has. We've gone through one budget battle after the other, and each feels more existential than the mm-hmm. one that preceded it. And so I think that's undermined confidence. Particularly on business people, and that's one reason why business people have been very cautious. They haven't really stepped up and invested and hired more aggressively. The good news is I think the budget battles are now over. Congress administration have one piece of legislation left, and that is to raise the Treasury debt limit. They've got to do that in the next few weeks. There'll probably be some brinkmanship around that, but I suspect that they'll sign that piece of legislation before it does too much economic damage, and then they go away. It'd be great if we had action and they could do more and invest in infrastructure, address immigration, earned income tax credit, minimum wage. But odds of that happening are very low. But it may not be a really bad thing if they just go away and do not much of anything, and let the private economy kick into gear here. And I think it will. It would be great if they could do some things, but maybe it won't be so bad, at least for the near future, if they just, kind of fade away.
And that was kind of embedded in what the president was talking about last night, which is, essentially going to state capitals, going to business leaders, going to universities and saying, okay, you've addressed some of these problems that Congress doesn't seem to be able to deal with.
Yeah, I think that is really where policy is headed. It's headed to state and local government. because it's going to be so difficult to get anything done at the federal level for, you know, the foreseeable future. And there's a lot of interesting good things happening, percolating up from various localities and states. And the president mentioned a couple things with regard to marrying universities with businesses with some help from the public sector. So those are the kinds of things that I think, you know, ultimately may come to fruition and will be helpful in a way to get around this this roadblock at the federal level.
And I've seen this referred to as a pen and phone strategy. I guess pen meaning the executive order, the phone strategy meaning just, you know, calling people up and mm-hmm. either bringing them to the White House or talking to them on the phone.
Well, you know, it's the bully pulpit, you know, factor. And he still has that. And, you know, if he can't go from the top down, he can try to work from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he still has dialogue. And, you know, there are ways perhaps to light a fire, arguably, underneath Congress. But again, through the political prism that we're talking about here, I think it would dovetail with what he hopes would be to give Democratic candidates in November, in the midterms, some tools, some conversational tools to bring their base out and say, okay, well, nothing's being done on the minimum wage at the federal level. What can we do at the state level? What kind of pressure can we bring to bear on our legislators and the candidates for federal office?
And I wonder how much the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, by November, will be, you know, 6 months or so after the important first sign-up. Will be a test for...
That was big. I was surprised last night by how much time he devoted in the speech to Obamacare and probably in some ways is maybe his most passionate section. I mean, he was defending it, and I mean, I was sitting there and I was thinking, now I wonder how, you know, vulnerable Democratic senators in red states... like North Carolina and Arkansas, you know, they're sitting there, and I'm thinking, does he think, you know, do they think that these talking points are going to help them or not? But you know, it was just striking when he basically said, you know, to the Republicans, like I think the quote you played at the top, you know, let's stop these repeal efforts, not talk about taking away things that millions of Americans already have, and I think that would be part of the argument that he's suggesting for Democratic candidates, that the Republicans want to take away stuff that people already have, benefits that they already have, and what do they have to replace it with? And frankly, going back to the Republican rebuttal last night, maybe the best thing Republicans should have done would have been to have there's two or three senators who actually introduced an alternative to Obamacare that's now... You know, it's now on the table. I haven't written about it yet, but I plan to. You know, it's got a fancy name. I don't know, the Patient Choice Affordability and Responsibility and Empowerment Act. And, you know, it's at least an attempt to say, if we're going to repeal it, here's what we would replace it with. It actually retains some features of Obamacare while loosening some others, such as the pre-existing condition thing that you know, it's basically saying, yeah, sure, you can still get insurance as long as you continue to keep your insurance, but it's hard for someone without it to get mm-hmm. it if you have a pre-existing condition. So that it drops out that requirement. But, you know, that's the Republicans know, at least instinctively at this point, finally, that they can't just say repeal it, that they have to talk about something as an alternative. And so there might be more dialogue there that Democrats can benefit on politically.
And, Mark, do you think the Affordable Care Act is here to stay, or do you think its future is uncertain?
Well, I think it's here to stay, but the script is still being written. I mean, there's still the possibility that it actually does fail. So one way that would occur is if we don't get enough younger people to sign up for these mm-hmm. programs. That would be a big problem for the healthcare reform. Another potential threat is that large employers start eliminating their own plans and asking their employees to go to these onto these exchanges. So, those are possible events that could completely undermine the plan and it would fail. But I don't think that's the most likely scenario. I think this will ultimately work out reasonably well. There will have to be some changes and tweaks, but I think it will. It will succeed and be the law of the land 10 years from now, more or less.
And that's Mark Zandi, who joins us along with Dick Pullman. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Hi, I'm Debbie Builder. I am one of the producers for Radio Times, and we are just taking a couple minutes to ask you to become a member of WHYY and support Radio Times. I'm here with Jeanette Woods, who is a producer for Newsworks, and I'm going to give you the number right off the bat so you can call in, show your support for Radio Times and all the other great programs that WHYY brings to you. It is 1-888-345-9499, or you can go online at whyy.org and pledge your support there.
And Debbie and I, we love coming and talking to you here. We always have a lot of fun, but we have that serious message that we want to get through to you, which is for wonderful programming like we're hearing this morning that Debbie works hard on, two shows a day. We need your support, and that's why we're here at the start of our membership campaign. I want to remind you again, the number to call for more of this wonderful programming to support Marty Moscowane, Radio Times, and other shows like this, 1-888-345-9499, or if you're at your desk, whyy.org. And we were just talking about some of the wonderful thank you gifts we have here, because there's always the thank you gift you want to kind of grab and run away with. Just right. Slip it under exactly. Your sweater and run. And right now we have this fantastic mug. It's a favorite. It's a collector's item. It shows the fabulous Marty Moscowane at the mic, rocking the mic.
Yep.
Her research and books. She's surrounded by research books. Her
piled
phone.
And piled up around her, like her office as well.
A little familiar. I know, it is like her office. And this is by our own wonderful artist-in-residence, digital artist-in-residence, Tony Auth. He has illustrated this mug, and this is something that's very popular, and it can be yours as a thank you for a pledge of $5 a month, the Radio Times mug. And you can do that right now by calling 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY, or whyy.org if you want to do that right now and ask for that mug. It's yours. Again, I might need to just flip this under my sweater.
I'm watching you, Jeanette.
Okay.
But if you're listening to Radio Times, you know the kind of quality of programming that we do. 500 shows a year Marty does.
Oh, wow.
That's 2 hours a day, weekdays, different topics. So today we're doing analysis of the State of the Union. Later we're talking about fathers and leave and paternity leave for dads. Tomorrow we're talking about the passenger pigeon, which is actually an incredibly interesting story about how it became extinct in a very short time from billions that would, you know, block the sun out there, these accounts of so many pigeons to being completely extinct. So that story is coming up tomorrow. You know the variety that Radio Times does, the quality of the guests, the great conversations that Marty brings to you every weekday. Give us a call. Show your support that you care about this program and all the other programs that WHYY does. The number is 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY. Go online and pledge your support there at whyy.org. Jeanette was mentioning the mug, and I think if you put it on a credit card, you get Wine Spectator magazine, too, which is, I'm looking at a copy. It's really
it's
very